tutta la morte.
Sweetie.
Say, Sweetie.
The house will cover the difference.
Yeah, madame.
I admire your courage, Miss...
Trench. Sylvia Trench. I admire your luck, Mr...
Bond. James Bond.
Mr. Bond, I suppose you wouldn't care to, raise the limit?
I have no objections.
When Commander Bond first played the tables back in the 1962 film Dr. No, it was Monte Carlo. Dinner jackets all around and ladies in diamond jewellery and tiaras. Casinos, the legal ones at least, were for the well-to-do, and they were relatively hard to come by. The UK had only just opened its first, and in Australia... Well, Australia in the early 1960s was still a decade away from building one. Today, according to the UK's Gambling Commission, there are 140 land-based casinos operating across Britain. And in Australia, there are 13, with another 3 mega casinos soon to come. Hello, welcome to Future Tense. Anthony Fennell here.
The edge of change. New ideas, new approaches, new technologies. This is Future Tense on RN and online.
Casinos aren't the only way to gamble. They never have been. Across Australia, there are now gaming machines in almost every pub and every club. And there's online betting too. But the bricks and mortar casino has a lot of life left in it yet. In fact, the industry is currently in the middle of a global building boom. Spencer Little is a senior analyst with the industry research firm IBISWorld.
Over the past 5 years, IBISWorld estimates that industry revenue has grown at an annualised 4.3%, so it has grown very strongly. Global casinos and online gambling industry set to be worth just under $285 billion in 2015, so it really is an enormous industry. To put that into some perspective, the Australian casinos industry is worth about $5.6 billion. So that's the Australian industry contributes to about 2% of total global casino revenue.
And my understanding is you estimate that that growth is going to continue over the next 5 or so years by about 5.3% annually. Is that correct?
That's correct, yes. Yeah. So for the global casinos and online gambling industry, yeah, growth is forecast to be very strong. In the Australian industry, it's set to be a little bit more subdued, but still growing nicely.
And significantly, we're seeing a change in direction for the industry internationally, aren't we? We're seeing a move away from North America and Europe towards Asia. Talk to us about that.
In the global industry over the past 5 years, what we have seen is that many casino operators have looked to these developing Asian markets to establish casinos. And we've seen some really strong growth in these regions. Many casino operators are looking at innovative ways to attract these wealthy gamblers and patrons.
And I understand Japan is also revising its legislation regarding the legalization of casinos. Is that likely to go ahead?
Absolutely. So, yeah, the story is that Japan, the Japanese government, might be removing these restrictions on casinos in Japan. One story was that it would be removed by November 2015. So this could really provide a lucrative opportunity for global casino operators, but also for Australian casino operators that are targeting these Asian patrons in particular.
Boarding completed.
Flight 229, you're clear for departure.
So the big casino and gambling companies have been hot-footing it to Asia, to the Philippines, to Singapore, and particularly to Macau, one of China's 2 special administrative regions. There are now 35 mega casinos operating in Macau alone. And here's another amazing figure. The Las Vegas Sands Corporation, the world's largest gaming company, now makes more than 65% of its total revenue from its Macau-based operations. It isn't that the US and Europe aren't still attractive to the gambling industry, but the economics make Asia a much more seductive bet. What with all that Chinese middle-class money that's suddenly on offer? And as I say, the facilities are getting bigger and flashier.
This is a trend we've seen over the past 5 years, again, in these developing sort of markets, Macau in particular. And it's a trend we're expecting to see continue over the next 5 years. In the news, three new casino proposals for the Australian industry. And these developments really are, they're planning to be, like you mentioned, mega casinos. And they're, again, really targeting high-stakes gamblers that really place large wagers on, particularly table games, blackjack, roulette, these type of games. Casino operators really target a broad demographic of gamblers. But what we have seen, again, over the past 5 years is that they're really trying to target these very wealthy gamblers from developing countries. They often offer incentives, subsidies, and other packages to attract these gamblers to their casinos. For example, accommodation and dining services may often be subsidized in an effort to get these patrons to place really large wagers on casino games. And this can obviously have a great effect on revenue and profitability for casino operators.
Now, here's another thing to take into account. The casino business is booming because it's found a whole lot of new patrons in Asia, sure. But it's also booming because governments around the world are much more relaxed about casinos and gambling than they were in the past. If you're wondering why, bear this in mind. According to IBIS World, around 20% of a casino operator's cost structure is now swallowed up in government taxes and levies. So having more casinos is good for casino owners, but it's also good for government coffers.
First of all, let me just say that governments, I always tell people, spell gaming T-A-X.
Tony McCoslin is an industry veteran and the CEO of an Australian company called Spin Cycle Gaming.
Governments see gaming as tax. I mean, it's a friendly way of raising tax revenue. So whatever governments say about gaming, they always eventually like it, because even the Opera House was built by a lottery. And in fact, most companies in places in Europe, like Spain, half their health services are driven by lotteries. Governments aren't going to get rid of gaming no matter what they say. So it is a way of raising tax. In the land-based business, I mean, it's worth billions of dollars, but even online, the estimates vary, but it's somewhere between $35 and $40 billion easily in regulated markets, and there's a lot of unregulated online too.
It's worth noting at this point that the workhorses of the gambling industry are still the physical clubs and casinos. It might be tempting to think that in a digital age, online gambling has taken over. But according to IBIS World, it's relatively small. Around 70% of global revenue, they estimate, still comes from traditional table gambling and electronic machines. One reason for that, according to Tony McCoslin, is that gambling via the internet is still officially banned in many countries. But, says McCoslin, change is inevitable.
I certainly think every government, both in first world countries and other countries around the world, have got an eye on the money that goes into online gaming. In China, they identified that they were losing about $50 billion a year in revenue going to offshore gaming and illicit online gaming. So they're all seeing that the best way for them to get revenue is to legalize online gaming. And that's where the sort of the trend is going to. All governments eventually, I think, will either issue licenses or certainly find ways of taxing people that are using online gaming.
Tony McCoslin. And I should mention that before setting up his current company, Spin Cycle Gaming, Tony worked for two of the largest gaming machine manufacturers in the world, Aristocrat and IGT. So with all that experience in gaming design, where does he see the industry heading? Well, Tony's eyes, and the eyes of the broader industry, he says, are well and truly locked on to the way in which young people these days play non-gambling games on their phones or their tablets or their laptops. And the question the industry is asking itself, he says, is how do we make games of wager more like games of fun and skill?
You've got to realise, obviously, that hand in hand with gaming is technology, and gaming drives a lot of technology because of the invested money in it. And there's lots of companies looking at things like, you know, virtual reality, you know, surround sound, touch screens, you know, even things, Rena, where the chair and the screen vibrate when you touch them so that you feel like a sensation of movement. There's this sort of word immersion where, you know, younger people are more immersed in a game. If, you know, you watch sort of the games they play, and I've got 8 and 10 year olds who play various games, and they're not just sitting there idly playing their game. They're actually immersed within the game. So there's more sound. There's all sorts of graphics that make it feel like you're surrounded by things and you're actually in another world. And so these guys that have played these kind of games, and I must say guys is the wrong term because it's really a lot of girls playing too, they've got this sort of expectation of being much more immersed in a game. So while they do drift to saying, look, we like the excitement of playing a wagering game, but we still want to have all those elements that we've grown up on.
So those expectations are not only, from what you're saying, those expectations are not only changing the nature of online gambling, but also the physical bricks and mortar gambling, the yeah, sorts of machines that are available in casinos.
Well, that's certainly happening around the world. I mean, just recently in Nevada, which is, you know, probably one of the biggest gaming regulators in the world, they've just announced last year that they're going to consider having a skill element allowed into a wagering slot game. So up until now, all games that are regulated had to be have a random number generated outcome, so that was always a random win. And now they're saying, look, to attract more younger players, we're going to have to start looking at new ways of designing games, and that means incorporating an element of skill. So that's where the world is going now. Pretty much everywhere you go, people have got a phone. Games and gaming on phones is going to probably be one of the biggest emerging industries in the world. I mean, somewhere like China, where they've got 750 million subscribers on mobile phones, they're looking for other ways of entertaining themselves. So games are where it's all happening. And the way that you sort of attract people, there's either short, sharp games where they can sort of, you know, use their memory or become attracted to various characters that they like to follow, or there's that thrill of winning, which is what wagering games are. And man, from earliest times that archaeologists can find, have liked gambling because it gives them a sense of thrill. And so therefore, incorporating sort of a winning element or a wagering element into a skill game is probably the next generation of games that everyone seems to be going to.
If you just look at what the corporations have been doing in the past couple of years, it's really telling of what they think the solution to the millennials or the next generation of potential gamblers is going to be. And what you see happening under the guise of so-called convergence are all of these partnerships, these mergers between big companies like International Gaming Technology and Zynga, which is one of the, if not the primary social media online game maker.
That's Natasha Shull, an associate professor with MIT's program in Science, Technology and Society. And she spent more than a decade studying gambling and technology.
So really what both sides are banking on, the side of the Facebook social media world and the side of the gambling industry, and also the video games such as World of Warcraft, etc., there's that whole sector as well, they're all banking on this convergence. And what it is it's a move toward what I sometimes call nano monetization. There's this effort, you know, it's not enough to just play World of Warcraft. Let's further monetize it by putting all sorts of little opportunities for clicks and likes and investments. You could say tons of little slot machine type interactions are being built in to those kinds of games, as well as things like Candy Crush, etc. At the same time, you see good old slot machines. It's no longer just about lining up the lemons. It's about bringing in some of the themes and qualities of video games and so-called social media games to liven them up for the younger generations.
So that idea of convergence there is about creating a very broad gambling culture within society.
Yes, broad and also mobile. I mean, that's critical here as well. There's this kind of always-on mentality and this idea that you could play a game, you know, on your way to work, on your lunch hour, and kind of tapping back into it. So the vision really is about broadening the scope and also making it mobile and constant.
Mobile and constant. Natasha Shull from MIT. At the University of Sydney, Fadi Anjul has also spent years studying the relationship between problem gambling and technology. He's the deputy director of the university's gambling treatment clinic. Dr. Anjul doesn't believe that simply making gaming machines more like social media or video games will necessarily lead to an increase in gambling. The evidence, he says, is not there. But like Natasha Schull, he's troubled by the connection between gambling and online and mobile platforms.
At this stage, it's quite concerning because historically, harm minimization has been geared toward electronic gaming machines. And all the sort of legislation and checks and balances that have been established are about, you know, how to sort of minimize impacts on gaming machines. This technology is new, and you know, legislation is always lagging behind new technology. So there isn't sort of an equivalence of harm minimization strategies that have been applied to gambling forms that can be accessed remotely. For example, you know, when you're going to a venue and you have this massive win, the legislation says, well, in New South Wales at least, that that massive win cannot be handed to you in cash. It has to be handed to you in the form of a check so as to prevent you from, you know, perhaps splurging further and dwindling your fortune on that particular day. There's, you know, a three-day cooling off period that's introduced to sort of minimize harm on that particular day. But no such restrictions occur in the area of online gambling. Unfortunately, most providers that offer an online platform to gamble also have facilities to connect directly to your credit card and also offer facilities to connect directly to your bank account, whereby you can make, you know, electronic transfers straight into your gambling account. And this has been unmitigated and unlimited. Therefore, on any particular day, you could effectively gamble away the balance of your credit card or the balance of your bank account, and there's no legislation to sort of preempt that or to manage that risk from occurring.
With the Ladbrokes app, you can transfer money from your betting account to your Ladbrokes card as fast as your little fingers can motor. Mickey! Ooh, dead heat, boys. The Ladbrokes app and the Ladbrokes card. Your cash.
The expenditure or the market share of online gambling appears to be quite low. You know, electronic gaming machines still dominate with excess of 60%. Unfortunately, there's also room to doubt those particular statistics on account of the fact that a lot of online gambling occurs with unauthorized and overseas providers. And there's no way of accounting for how much gambling occurs if you don't know where it's actually occurring. So if the official statistics are whatever percentage, my assumption is that, you know, the real figure is probably considerably much higher than that. In terms of trends, I mean, we have, I think, a better understanding of the growth in terms of a percentage growth of this particular form of gambling. And, you know, the figures kind of range anywhere from, you know, say 5 or 7% to right up to 20% per annum. And so these growth figures seem to have been sustained for, you know, the past decade or so. And, you know, based on projections, you know, in another 10 years, this could be the dominant form of gambling in the future.
And once again, as with many areas of technology, regulation and the authorities are way behind in terms of looking at this as a trend, as an issue.
Absolutely. Recently, there's been a call from, you know, authorised online providers of gambling in Australia to try and toughen up the flow of overseas money because, you know, they're concerned that in the future, you know, this will cut into their own market share. But at this stage, it's not quite clear what governments could possibly be doing to mitigate, you know, gambling overseas other than educate gamblers about, you know, the risks they perhaps incur by placing bets with a provider who's not regulated. But probably better measures are going to be offering information to gamblers themselves to mitigate their attitudes towards gambling as a product, insofar as ensuring that they're educated and well-informed about the choices they're making in respect of the probability that they will win or lose.
And that's exactly what Dr. Anjul and his colleagues at the Gambling Treatment Clinic at Sydney University are doing, using reason and mathematical logic to convince problem gamblers that the odds really are stacked against them. And their success rate, Fadi Anjul says, is encouraging. with the majority of those who've attended the clinic managing to moderate their betting behaviour. This is Future Tense. I'm Anthony Fennell, and our subject today is gambling and technology. Toward the beginning of the program, we highlighted the fact that while online gambling is getting a lot of attention, traditional offline betting still accounts for the lion's share of gambling revenue. And we heard from MIT's Natasha Schull, who recently put all of her research into a book called Addiction by Design, Machine Gambling in Las Vegas. Dr. Schull says it's important not to overlook the fact that slot machines, what we in Australia call poker machines, are huge money earners. And casino operators have, over the last few decades, invested vast amounts of money in refining their technology.
They aren't designed to manipulate gamblers in the sense that people are sitting around in some corporate boardroom rubbing their hands together and saying, how can we addict people? But what they're doing is they've got massive volumes of data, you could say, showing which features people play more intensively, which are more profitable and which aren't. So it's just like McDonald's. The way they learned their recipe for the hamburger was seeing where the lines were longest. So in that sense, it's not this intentional drive to addict people. The intention is to make more money. And the technological innovations that we've seen, I'd say since the 1980s, have really empowered that project of increasing revenue through slot machines. Slot machines, sure, they always wanted to make money, but they weren't considered an important money driver for the gambling industry. They were often in these sort of transitory spaces, hallways, next to registration desks in hotels, and typically they didn't have stools. Part of the reason that that situation has reversed so much, and now you see 75 to 90% of revenues in U.S. casinos, at least, come from machines, is because of microprocessors, different kinds of algorithm development for the games, and also video technology has been a huge driver of that reversal of fortune of the slot machine, you could say. The reason that contemporary gambling machines are so compelling, so potent, if you will, really boils down to three characteristics. They're solitary, they are rapid, and they are continuous. So solitary matters because it's not a game like poker where you have to take other players into account, look across the table, or even online, you've still got to wait for other players to take their turn. So the social element is removed. That means that cues for stopping are also removed. And it speeds things up, and that brings us to rapid. You can play up to 1,200 spins or hands an hour. So the event frequency, the amount of times that these stimulating, compelling events are happening is super turbo speed. And then the continuous part is really important, the fact that you're not interrupted. People aren't interrupting you. The machine is designed to keep the flow going. So typically, you're not even interrupted by having to put in coins anymore because you're playing off of credits. So the whole process of making an investment in the next hand or spin is completely invisible to gamblers.
And behind the curtain, so to speak, with all of this, isn't just the development of new technology or the honing of new technology, but also it's data, isn't it? It's the ability to gather data on the way in which gamblers respond to stimuli.
Yeah, one of the reasons that my research in this area went on far longer than I had expected is because each time I thought I could wrap it up and finish the book, some new innovation came on the scene. And the last of those innovations that really slowed the book process down was the data tracking. It has now become critical, a critical part of any casino operation, and indeed any slot machine, to very intensively track the data that gamblers are giving as they sit there and play. Some people, you know, if you put this in the terms of a laboratory scientist, it's key press data, meaning you've got this someone sitting there who's actually pressing a button And you can calculate so many variables off of that. How fast are they pressing it in relation to certain events in the game? When do they taper off? When do they leave? How long are their playing sessions? What does their spouse play? What kind of drinks do they like? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And you can really process this data in ways that can aid your marketing.
Tell us about what's called the machine zone. What exactly does that term mean?
So the term machine zone, which is one that gamblers in different jurisdictions, English-speaking jurisdictions around the world have been found to use, is this term to describe that state that one tends to enter if you're intensively gambling. The zone is a state in which time falls away, space, a sense of space in your surroundings. You can go so far that you will even forget. One man told me he forgets the name of his children when he's gambling. So it's really this state of nothingness. And I found throughout the years of my research that quite counterintuitively, gamblers are not so much playing to win when they reach that sort of state of addiction. They are playing for the zone. They're playing to zone out. If you go into a casino and you can really tell if someone's in the zone, you know, not if they're sitting up in their seat expectantly, agitatedly, excitedly, looking at the screen, watching with a great sense of expectation what's going to come down, but rather sitting back very passively, maybe just moving one finger, a glazed expression on the face. The zone is not a state of excitement. People may begin gambling because they hope to win, because they're after the thrill of it, the anticipation of it, and they may be excited the first times they gamble. But those who gamble enough to become problem gamblers or gambling addicts, these are not gamblers who sustain that level of excitement. Through their interactions with these devices, they learn that what the machine is really good at is not giving them a win, but giving them that kind of numb, hypnotic relief. And that's what they then begin to seek. So it can, I like to say sometimes that the thrill of winning may be the hook, but the zone is the hold.
Do you see philosophical questions for our society about whether or not we're happy as society to have gambling organisations deliberately honing this kind of technology, this sort of science, in order to keep people in the so-called machine zone?
Well, the whole premise of my book is that we really need to understand this. There's so many decisions being made at the legislative level. Here in the States, we're in the middle of a huge turn toward gambling expansion, precisely to fill budget shortfalls without raising taxes. And I find that really disturbing that legislators who really don't understand the difference between a home poker game or sports betting and a slot machine feel so comfortable endorsing these devices. I really think there has to be more conversation and understanding by policymakers and the public about how these machines are working. What are the different ways that they are manipulating, that they are deceptive, etc., before they're brought into communities to basically raise revenue not just for corporations but also for states.
Natasha Shull from the Program in Science, Technology and Society at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We also heard today from Spin Cycle Gaming's Tony McCoslin, Dr. Fadi Anjul from Sydney University's Gambling Treatment Clinic, and Spencer Little, a senior analyst with industry research firm Ibis World. Thanks to my co-producer Karin Savanovitz and sound engineer Peter McMurray. I'm Anthony Fennell. You've been listening to Future Tense. Until next time, cheers.
Tony Abbott has pleaded,
pull back from this brink.
And if that doesn't move Joko Widodo and spare the lives of two young Australians facing the death penalty in Indonesia, then there's also this warning.
We will certainly be finding ways to make our displeasure felt.
So what will be the repercussions? Join me, Tom Switzer, for a discussion on the state of Australian-Indonesian relations on Between the Lines. Online anytime at the RN homepage.